after a very nice holiday weekend break, we hit the ground running here on Tuesday on WKAR's Current State with a very busy show here today for you. We hope you can stick around for this. Susan Woods is standing by to join us here to talk more about the indie film series here in Lansing. For those of you who like independent films or films outside the mainstream a little bit, Susan will bring us up to speed on that. Hear about Anthony Iani later this hour. A lot of Spartan fans know about Anthony. He's believed to be the first person with a disorder on the autism spectrum to play Division I college basketball, and he did so here, of course, at Michigan State University and graduated, so more from Anthony in just a little bit. At the top of our program, this summer, the Obama administration put America's energy industry on notice. A new mandate from the Environmental Protection Agency requires the nation to cut carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants by nearly a third by the year 2030. At the same time, many states, including ours, are discussing how they should increase energy efficiency through renewable sources. In March, Governor Rick Snyder said he'd like to see Michigan achieve a 30 to 40% increase in renewable energy sources while reducing waste. State lawmakers are presenting a host of bills that seek to meet these and other goals. The Snyder administration says Michigan will submit its compliance plan for the Clean Power Plan 1 year from now, September 2016. Joining me now to talk about the implications of Michigan's energy future are two guests. Dan Bishop is Director of Media Relations for Consumers Energy in Jackson. Welcome, Dan.
Good morning, Mark.
And Sarah Mulcoff is the Energy Program Director for the Michigan Environmental Council. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. Good morning.
We're happy to consider our listeners' questions as well this morning. Tweet us those at KAR Current State or email us currentstate@wkar.org. At the top, Dan, give us your thoughts on the implementation of this state plan. I believe it's called SCIP or S. It's the State Carbon Implementation Plan. Who's hammering that out? Who has a voice at the table here?
I sure can, Mark. And as you've indicated, this is a huge issue. It's going to really dramatically and dynamically impact Michigan's energy market. So this is the next set of EPA regulations, if you will. We have a current set of EPA regulations that is impacting the state by driving the shutdown of 9 coal plants in Michigan. But this next set, the Clean Power Plan, is going to require states to come up with a significant carbon reduction plan. You know, the state last week announced its intent to begin the process of developing a state implementation plan. We think that makes good sense. We think having a Michigan-first energy plan is the right approach for our customers and for our state, so we support.
What does that mean?
That really means that this is a complex process where the state has to look at the energy future and figure out how are we going to reduce carbon in terms of our energy production. We've got coal plants shutting down. We'll be transitioning more toward natural gas. We'll be increasing emphasis on reducing energy waste, and renewables are going to have an important role to play as well, but it's a very complex process. Interestingly, the Toledo Blade had an editorial on Friday with an amazing headline about Michigan's energy wisdom, commending the state for announcing this process.
Sarah, what do you think belongs in this plan here? We're at the beginning of the process here, but what's a priority as far as the Michigan Environmental Council? You might also want to say, and you're both welcome to weigh in on this, what doesn't belong in this plan? What
Sure.
belongs in it and what doesn't belong in it?
Thanks. Well, we were really impressed and appreciative of seeing the state's leadership on taking its own direction for the state carbon implementation plan. And so it's going to be between cross agencies that are leading it, the Michigan Agency for Energy, the MEDC, the Department of Environmental Quality, and the MPSC, hope to work with a wide variety of stakeholders on the process too. And so we hope to be part of those groups at the table, starting to think about which compliance options we do have for reducing carbon in Michigan. So the way the rule is proposed is that there's a series of different building blocks and different approaches that we can do here in Michigan to reduce carbon emissions. And there's also different approaches between doing a rate-based calculation on carbon reduction versus mass-based per megawatt hours. Either will result in reduction of CO2, but from our perspective, we would want to encourage the path towards energy efficiency and using renewables as part of that program.
Dan, go a little deeper with us on that, Dan. What? Go ahead.
Sure. We think a really critical issue here, Mark, is that Michigan and its energy policy leaders really take control of our energy future. You know, we don't want control to be in the hands of Washington, if you will. Our 1.8 million customers, they want affordability, sustainability, and reliability. Those are really the key attributes. And ensuring that we've got a Michigan First plan really makes sense. So if you look at the transition, what's happening, less reliance on coal, you know, 9 coal plants shutting down in Michigan by 2016, that includes 7 consumers energy plants that have served the state well for 60 years. And in 8 months, those plants will be shutting down. So looking forward, less reliance on coal plants, an increased use of natural gas. We're adding a 540-megawatt natural gas plant in our hometown of Jackson. It's about 10 blocks from our corporate headquarters. And also, there's no question that the federal plan is going to require increased investment in renewables and increased focus on reducing energy waste, which is something that the governor has called for in his major policy address.
We're talking about Michigan's evolving energy policy. Our guest today, Dan Bishop, Director of Media Relations for Consumers Energy, also Sarah Mulcoff, the Energy Program Director for the Michigan Environmental Council. A particular issue here in Michigan is the sheer cost of electricity. We have the highest electricity costs in the Midwest, if I'm not mistaken. Everybody would like them lower. There's a bill in the Senate right now, Senate Bill 438, and its supporters argue that the way to lower electricity rates for Michigan residents is not through more government mandates or regulations that basically order them to implement what they claim is more expensive green measures. Where does the Environmental Council stand on 438, Sarah?
Sure. We think there's a number of ways to address how to lower rates, electric rates in the state. And first, it would be to establish clear goals for the utilities to meet. Our very successful current energy law, the PA 295, has led to great investments in renewable energy and energy efficiency. So we know that those investments that are marked by goals or standards allow the state to close plants and not have to replace them because we're using energy more efficiently. We also know that we can address capacity constraints through rate design, and so actually sending better price signals to customers, and of course better utilizing which current plants are in capacity and closing those marginal units. And so Senate Bill 437 makes a number of changes to how we look at the definition of renewable energy. They use something more of like a clean energy resource. We want to ensure that a true renewable energy standard takes into account public health through reduced emissions and also doesn't phase out these very successful renewable energy and energy efficiency standards.
Dan, does consumers support Senate Bill 438?
We do support Senate Bill 438, Mark. I will make a point about reliability and affordability, really. It's an interesting and a challenging issue. We have made some recent progress on this. So we are in compliance with PA 169, which really says, let's ensure that energy-intensive businesses in the state, job creators, have the opportunity to have a competitive electric rate so that they can create jobs in our state. We're in compliance with that. In fact, the state's announcement last week about the SIP process cited the fact that we're making progress in terms of making electric cost more affordable for manufacturers. We also took a look at actual bills paid by residential customers. So while rates tend to be a little bit higher, actual bills in Michigan, because we tend to be a cooler state, the last week notwithstanding, air conditioning use tends to be less in Michigan than in other states. So actual bills were about the 15% below the national average. So more progress to make in terms of affordability, but we're doing some good work on that front.
Sarah, let me ask you, would a greener energy landscape also enable push costs lower? Could a greener, because this strikes me as maybe one of the points of contention here between the two of you. You would advocate for a greener energy landscape, but would a greener energy landscape also lower costs?
Yeah, we think it would. If you're talking green in terms of true renewable energies,
yes,
such as solar and wind, solar, for instance, the price of solar contracts has been steadily coming down. And what's great about that is it locks in low rates into 20 or 30 year contracts over a long period of time. And again, this is a $0 for the fuel used for solar as well. And that's something that we see as more reliable than volatile cost of fossil fuels that we can't predict in the same way as some of the long-term renewable contracts.
But Dan, you have some concerns over that.
We
you
do.
Have concerns over too many green energy mandates.
Yeah, I think in general. So Sarah's organization and ours would in general be in alignment on a lot of issues. But when it comes to subsidies, we think that's an issue that should be discussed. When it comes to mandates, that's really an issue that state policymakers are wrestling with, and they'll be the deciders of that. As just as a general philosophical issue, shifting cost from one set of customers to another, we think is inappropriate. It's an issue of fairness. We think customers, to the best extent we can do, really should pay for a fair price for electricity. That's an actual price. So lessening subsidies or reducing those, we think, is an important and valuable approach.
We're talking about Michigan's evolving energy policy, its energy future. Dan Bishop of Consumers Energy joins us. Also, Sarah Mulcoff, Energy Program Director for the Michigan Environmental Council. Speaking of cost shifting, one of the most talked about issues recently has been net metering. This is the existing program whereby customers can install their own renewable electric generation devices, home solar, if you will, rooftop solar. It usually means solar panels. There's been legislation filed in the last month by the Michigan House Republicans that would eliminate net metering at the retail rate and instead compensate people at the wholesale rate. There's been counter legislation also filed to expand the net metering program. You two are on opposite sides of this one. Dan, Consumers is an advocate for change here. What's wrong, what's unfair about net metering right now?
Sure, so a couple of thoughts, Mark, about solar. One, we support solar energy. We know that it has an important role to play. In our view, the studies are clear that utility-scale solar projects make the most sense. They're about twice as efficient as rooftop solar. There's less of an environmental footprint. They produce less carbon. We're working very closely with Grand Valley State University and Western Michigan University on large, what we call our solar gardens program. And these are larger scale programs. They work well. It's really an exciting thing. We're quite pleased about that. When it comes to rooftop solar, it's a very small number of participants in Michigan. There's about 1,800, according to the Michigan Public Service Commission, about 400 for our system. They're not as efficient, but the real issue has been pricing. They have not really been fairly priced. We think as a matter of fairness that all customers should pay their true cost of supporting the electric grid, which is really a critical thing for our state.
And our existing net metering setup, I think, is a little bit more, you tend to favor that. Sarah, tell us why.
Yeah, we actually agree to some extent in that we think that distributed generation customers also need to pay their fair share of delivery to the grid, but not for what they generate. And so the utilities are already getting paid by their other customers for the delivery of power by distributed generation. And we agree that all costs should be evaluated, including the line loss and grid stability. But the changes to it would truly make it unfair to some of those distributed gen customers. And we don't think that there's been enough fair evaluation or research about the supposed subsidies that are placed on those net metering customers.
This does seem like a disincentive to people, Dan, who have gone so far as to install rooftop solar.
Yeah, we've been a real clear, Mark, that we think there should be discussion about grandfathering those folks that have made that installation under the previous set of rules. They had made an investment. There ought to be some discussion about including them under the old set of rules, and I think that is happening. But the industry and our company has looked at the subsidy received by rooftop solar installation participants. It's a very significant subsidy. It could be as high as 65%. And as that program grows, we think it's really important to get the pricing right. We think, in fact, that a lot of folks will look more at the utility scale solar option to participate in that. We think that just is more efficient and a more fair approach, if you will.
We're just about out of time, mm-hmm. but I want to ask both of you about the renewable energy mandate, renewable energy portfolio. Can you each give me a percentage as mm-hmm. to what should happen to the 10% mandate that expires at the end of this year? What should that number be, Sarah?
Yeah, we'd like to see the RPS continue to increase by 1.5% annually, as well as our energy efficiency savings goals.
And that puts us where? 1.5% annually puts us?
By 2022, that would put us at about 20%.
Dan Bishop. I'll decline from an exact number, Mark. It's really the mandate issue is up to state policymakers. But with the dynamic change of the clean power plant coming, less coal plants in Michigan, more renewable energy, reducing energy waste and renewable energy have to play a role going forward.
Would consumers like it to just go away completely?
We know that renewable energy is important. It's got an important role to play in our future.
There's lots more to this landscape. We want to thank our two guests for clarifying it a little bit. Here we've been talking about Michigan's evolving energy policy. Sarah Mulcoff is the Energy Program Director for the Michigan Environmental Council. Dan Bishop, Director of Media Relations for Consumers Energy. Sarah and Dan, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so
much. Thank you.
Lord Huron there. It's called The Birds Are Singing at Night. Lord Huron performing back in Michigan 1 week from tomorrow night at Grand Rapids, Covenant Fine Arts Center in Grand Rapids. And we're trying to schedule a time here where we can talk with Ben Schneider of Lord Huron about the performance and about it's four or five songs that Lord Huron has contributed to Walk in the Woods. So if you go see Walk in the Woods with Robert Redford and Nick Nolte and Emma Thompson, you will hear four or five of Lord Huron's songs in that movie. So well done, Lord Huron. Hopefully Ben Schneider next week here on Current State. Well, box office hits and blockbusters appeal to the masses, but independent films often tell stories that are off the beaten path. The indie film series just started in Lansing on Friday and will run until October 1st. Here to tell us more about it is Susan Woods. She's not only the founder of the indie film series, but also the East Lansing Film Festival. And in all the spare time that she enjoys, she still sees fit to serve on the East Lansing City Council. So I don't know how the city council gig breaks up your whole day, it sounds
it
like,
does.
Susan.
Oh, I tell you, those politics.
Welcome back to the
Thank
show.
Thank you.
You're a founder of the Film Festival, which is coming up in November, but you also started this indie film series happening now in Lansing. How did that get started? How far back does it go?
Just to correct you, it's not in Lansing, it's in Okemos.
I beg your pardon. It's at Studio C.
Studio C at the Meridian Mall. So essentially what it is that in 1998 we held the first film festival, and then the Odeon, which was our only art house theater, closed that summer, and I was thrown the gauntlet. So I picked it up and created the East Lansing film series, and then Celebration approached me, and we partnered, and then we moved to the brand new Studio C 2.5 years ago.
And what do you like about independent films?
Absolutely. I think that they're intelligent, they're creative, they are enthralling. You can have documentaries that are extremely informative, moving. Those are kinds of things that are done out of sheer intelligence and love and not for the bottom dollar.
You've selected six films for the series, which we'll hear about the first. How did you decide which ones to include?
Well, three of them I had seen at the Traverse City Film Festival.
Okay.
So, you know, and I knew that they were very good. One of them is for children and adults, and that's from the famous Japanese studio that does anime, and it's called When Marnie Was There. The studio Ghibli. So I always show that film. And then Infinitely Polar Bear was one that had done very well, as well as Testament of Youth, which is a British film, and it's sort of the Downton Abbey, and I know how popular Downton Abbey is in this area.
Well, you like one of the films so much, you're holding a discussion after one of the screenings. This is Clouds of Sils Maria.
Yes.
Do I have that right?
It's a terrible title.
Yeah. Tell us just a little bit about this one.
Well, it stars Juliette Binoche and Kristen Stewart, who is a complete surprise in it, from the Twilight series. And it's essentially about an actress who is asked to reprise a role, but not as the ingenue, but as the older woman. And it involves so many different layers about celebrity, aging, acting, amazing, you know, what it takes to for an actor to become their role. And mm-hmm. it's a fascinating, and it's on so many levels. That's why I'm holding the discussion.
We have a clip of that one. Let's listen to a little bit. Juliette Binoche, who plays the actress, Kristen Stewart, who plays her assistant.
Do you want to christen a shopping mall in Nanking?
No.
An interview with an Italian magazine targeting active women, seduction after 40.
No.
But it's the cover.
No.
Clouds of Sils Maria. Who's participating in the discussion?
Well, the one who's naming all these ridiculous jobs that she could do is Kristen Stewart, her assistant. And then Juliette Binoche is the one who's laughing, just saying it's ridiculous. But it just shows what celebrity is. I mean, these people must get requests constantly.
It's like the American superstars who do commercials, but they only do them in Europe and Japan.
Exactly.
You hear about
mostly Japan. They pay phenomenal. I mean, Woody Allen did a commercial there because they paid him $3 million.
And this kind of explores that from the women's point of view.
Right.
The next clip we have is from a movie you alluded to a second ago, Infinitely Polar Bear. Let's hear the beginning of that trailer, and then you can tell us more about it.
Okay.
My father was diagnosed manic depressive in 1967. He'd been going around Cambridge in a fake beard. He met my mother there. She didn't care, so they got married, and they had me, and then my sister. We were happy. I know there's more to it than that. There always is.
Tell us more about this. This features a lead character played by
Mark Ruffalo.
Mark Ruffalo, who is bipolar in the movie,
right,
and his struggles.
Essentially what it is that he's kicked out of the home, and then the wife, Zoe Saldana, is accepted to Wharton Business School. So she needs him to take care of the kids. So he moves back in, and they have incredibly funny, sad adventures throughout. But it really puts a face on a very, very serious disease that is affecting so many people.
We're speaking with Susan Woods, founder of the Indie Film Festival, and listening to some clips from some of her featured films. This next one is a documentary that sounds just too weird to be true. Really compelling idea. It's called The Wolf Pack. Tell us a little bit about The Wolf Pack.
Unbelievable. It is essentially what happened was that the director, Crystal Musselle, was walking down the East Village in New York and saw seven boys all dressed up in black suits, white shirts, and skinny ties and dark glasses, and said, "I've never seen you in this neighborhood. I know this neighborhood by heart." And she found out that these were six boys that had never left their apartment except for maybe once a year. They had been hit. Their father believed that they had to be protected from society. Mm. And she gains their confidence. And their only outlet into the world were movies. And Quentin Tarantino was their favorite. And so they would reenact all the films. And we get to see what they do.
So they lived this extraordinarily sheltered life.
Right.
And then Quentin Tarantino, who blows a lot of people's minds for people who get out in the world,
right,
they get exposed to his movies. Let's listen to the beginning of the trailer for The Wolf Pack.
My parents didn't encourage us to communicate with society, so we were kind of shut off. always lived in this apartment.
In the summer, there was more chance of us getting out. Sometimes we go out once a year.
This is like 3D, man.
It's very fresh out here.
And at one particular year, we never got out at all.
So the wolf pack, it's almost like, where's the title come from? Is this like kids being raised by wolves or what?
Oh,
okay.
Yeah,
okay.
That's what it is. And let me tell you, the mama wolf is the reason why they're such incredibly wonderful human beings. And you'll see that in this movie. It is, I just sat there with my jaw open. Mm. I could not believe that this was happening.
Sounds extraordinary. The film series is currently underway. It'll run until October 1st. Susan, where can we go to see the films? It's Studio C. Okemos.
Studio C, right behind the Meridian Mall. It's the state-of-the-art theater. You can have food. You can have drink. And it runs the times are different every day, so you have to really, we'll have programs available. And if you want, if you go to SusanW.Woods@gmail.com and request a brochure, I will mail one to you.
SusanW.Woods@gmail.com. @gmail.com.
Sorry about that.
Email Susan and you will get more in return.
Yes.
Very good. We've been speaking with Indie Film Series founder Susan Woods. Susan, thank you for joining
us. Well, thank you, Mark.
Have a successful festival.
Oh, thank you.
And coming up on Current State, the Michigan Department of Transportation has plans to renovate a 6.7-mile stretch of I-94 near Detroit. The agency says it'll make the highway safer and reduce traffic congestion, but environmentalists are raising concerns about the impact. We talked to Nick Schroke of the Great Lakes Environmental Law Center. Also, current sports host Al Martin talks to MSU basketball player Anthony Iani about how family support and his own persistence made him the first athlete with autism to play in Division I college basketball in the USA. That and more coming up after the break on Current State. Well, more and more Current State listeners are telling us they'll be joining us tomorrow night for our first pop-up stories event. We hope you will be among them, either to tell a story, our theme is hungry and fed, or just to listen to everyone else's stories. We get started at 5:30 at the Allen Neighborhood Center. The farmer's market is going on there at the same time, hence the theme, hungry and fed. More information on our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories. We hope to see you there, 5:30 to 7 tomorrow night. Mike Scorey plays some music. You tell some stories. You listen to some stories. It's a first of its kind for us here. We're excited about it. There's a couple more to follow before the snow flies as well. If there's one thing that most Michiganders can agree on, it's that our roads are in terrible shape. As to how to fix them, well, that's another matter. Take, for example, I-94, a notoriously congested stretch of road, which was built in the 1940s and 1950s. The Michigan Department of Transportation has laid out a $3 billion plan to repair and modernize a 6.7-mile stretch of that highway near Detroit, but some environmental groups are raising concerns about the impact of expanding the highway's footprint. And they say MDOT needs to do an updated environmental assessment before moving forward. Here to talk about those concerns is Nick Schroke, Executive Director of the Great Lakes Environmental Law Center. Nick, welcome back to Current State.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
For starters, where is this 7-mile stretch of highway?
Yeah, it's right through the city of Detroit. So basically from I-96 all the way to Connor. So it's about a 7-mile stretch all through the city of Detroit.
And tell us a little bit more about the scope of the project. What exactly do MDOT's plans call for?
Right. So when MDOT completed their environmental study back in 2004, what was contemplated at that time is the same thing that they're planning on right now, which would be adding an additional lane of traffic, both on the eastbound and westbound highway lanes, and then also adding continuous service drives, three lanes of service drives continuously along that same 7-mile stretch. So in effect, you're adding about eight lanes of traffic when you add it all in together.
Is that a done deal, Nick, that approach?
Well, no. So what MDOT's been saying to us is that they're sort of rethinking and trying to decide whether or not they still need that same footprint of a highway. So they had a series of meetings back about a month ago, meeting with community members and other groups to try and talk about, you know, is that plan still what's needed for the region and what's needed for the city of Detroit?
Well, the highway was built over 50 years ago using designs that no one would use, building a highway today. MDOT has said that safety is the topmost concern when it comes to deciding what the new freeway will look like. What are some of the safety issues that will be addressed by the MDOT plan?
Well, anyone who's driven along that stretch knows that there's some areas where you have entrance and exit ramps along the left-hand side of the road, meaning that people are merging into the fastest lanes of traffic, as well as there's some trunk lines where you come in off of, say, the Lodge onto I-94, where you have to cross over multiple lanes of traffic. And so those types of design things are a problem, and they're outdated. But what we're saying is you can fix those issues without having to significantly enlarge the footprint of the highway and add those additional lanes of traffic. And the reason why we're raising these concerns is because all of the data that MDOT relied on in coming up with this expansion plan turned out to be wrong. They made assumptions about traffic growth and about increases in vehicle miles traveled, and all of that turned out to be wrong. Now here we are 10, 11 years down the road from when they completed their last study, and we're just saying, look, if you've relied on all of these assumptions that were incorrect, we need to go back and make sure that we still would need this type of an expansion. And really, could we save some money by just fixing the highway, addressing some of those safety concerns, and not going forward with an expansion?
But, Nick, they MDOT acknowledges that the assumptions were wide of the mark?
They do. So what happened was they actually went back and did an updated traffic count in October of last year, October of 2014, and they found that in most areas along that 7-mile stretch, there had actually been a decrease in traffic going back to the early 2000s. So we actually have less traffic on the road today. And they did adjust their projections into the future, but they're still calling for, you know, fairly significant increases in traffic moving ahead 20 years. And that's where we're questioning those assumptions, you know, whether or not that's actually going to happen, because they've been wrong time and again. And so we're just really, you know, wondering why we should believe them now when they've been wrong in the past.
Nick Schroek is the executive director of the Great Lakes Law Center and a professor at Wayne State University. We're talking today about the opposition to expanding a 6.7-mile stretch of I-94 in downtown Detroit. So another environmental assessment is really in order here.
Well, that's what we're calling for. So there's something called the National Environmental Policy Act, which is the federal law that calls for these environmental assessments before major federal dollars are spent on any big project that's likely to have environmental impacts. And there's a process when you have these types of things happen where you have an environmental assessment that was done back in the early 2000s. It sat on the shelf for all these years. Well, things change. We've had significant changes in population in the city of Detroit. Unfortunately, our population has gone down significantly within the project area. People are driving less, and we have new things that need to be considered, such as climate change. Now, under federal law, you have to consider potential climate impacts from a project. And so all of those things, along with some others, were not considered back with this assessment in the early 2000s. And so under the National Environmental Policy Act, there's a process for something called a supplemental environmental impact statement. And that's what we're seeking, is a supplemental where they go back and look at, based on all of these changing circumstances, is this highway expansion still considered the least polluting alternative, or the alternative that's likely to get the job done with the fewest environmental impacts? And we're not sure that that's the case because the study's so old and outdated.
MDOT has said it's committed to right-sizing the project. It's not interested in just unconsidered expansion. This project would start in 2019, would not be finished until 2036.
Right.
There is a case to be made that making the highway wider would help accommodate population growth and more traffic, is there not?
Well, that's interesting. Actually, a lot of research has been done looking at, you know, if you add lanes of traffic to a highway, do you actually reduce congestion, or do you just end up funneling more traffic onto that highway that would have been using surface streets and other modes of transportation? And there's this idea of induced demand, we call it, where you have these extra lanes on a highway, and you basically funnel more traffic there, but you end up back in the same level of congestion that you had.
If you build it, they will come.
Exactly right.
Is that it?
And there is actual research showing that happens. And so, you know, we're just saying, look, let's not take this project little piece by piece. You know, as you mentioned, it would be ongoing for the next 20 years. You know, are there ways that we can you know, right-sizing the words that MDOT wants to use. We want a supplemental environmental impact statement to look at the project in its entirety as a whole and see whether or not this expansion is needed. It's very expensive, you know, $3 billion to do this expansion and modernization of the highway. And, you know, our point is we can't afford to fix the roads that we have right now and the vehicle lanes we have currently. You know, why do we need to be expanding this highway here where it doesn't look like it's needed based on all the traffic data?
If you look at some of the reporting that's come out on this project, a lot of people leaving comments are complaining about the existing congestion on this stretch of roads. Would you concede there will be some benefits if you live in these nearby neighborhoods to relieving gridlock and idling cars coming in and out of the city? How do you respond to those people who live nearby who complain about congestion?
Sure. And that's the idea of if you have this bumper-to-bumper traffic where it's not flowing, cars idling, of course there can be more air pollution associated with that. What we've actually heard from many residents along this corridor is that by adding more lanes, adding more service drives, you're likely to funnel more traffic into the area and arguably make that air pollution worse just by virtue of having more cars and trucks going through that corridor. So while it is true, certainly, to say that if you have traffic moving in general, that's better for localized air pollution impacts because you don't have idling cars and trucks, the concern is that by funneling more cars into this corridor, you're going to have additional air pollution impacts. And that's one of the concerns that we've raised in our comments to MDOT, is that here you have an area of the city that is already polluted. It's congested. We have I-75 right there. You have the Lodge Freeway. You have the Detroit Incinerator. You have large auto plants. And so adding potentially more cars right into that corridor could very well impact the air quality for residents.
Moving forward then, what are you hoping to see from MDOT? Is there a resolution that doesn't involve an additional environmental study?
Well, one of the things that's interesting is that MDOT's been meeting with a bunch of different stakeholders. They've met with Wayne State University, with Henry Ford Hospital, with Midtown Inc. here in Detroit, and they're having all these meetings in separate. And one of the problems with that is that we don't really know what they're saying to each individual stakeholder. We'd really like an open public process where you have meaningful opportunities for public comment and public engagement, where citizens, people can actually comment on MDOT's proposal and get some feedback from the agency. And the problem right now is that while they're doing some of these listening tours and they're going out and meeting with the public, it's really not an actual public engagement process where it's covered by our federal law and that people have feedback that they receive from the agency. And that is partly because we don't know what MDOT's ultimate plan is right now. They're basically saying they're going to right-size or rethink this project, but they haven't said, does that right-sizing include additional lanes of traffic on the freeway as well as these continuous service drives?
Nick Schroek is Executive Director of the Great Lakes Environmental Law Center. We've been talking today about concerns being raised by the environmental community about plans to modernize and potentially expand a stretch of I-94 in Detroit. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And this segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. We're also with you every weekday at noon on AM 870 WKAR and always at WKAR.org. At the age of 4, Okemos native Anthony Iani was diagnosed with pervasive developmental disorder, a condition on the autism spectrum. Doctors told Anthony's parents that he would barely graduate from high school, would never graduate from college, and would likely need to be institutionalized for his adult life. His parents were devastated, but pledged that Anthony would be successful no matter what. And he is. Despite bullies and numerous personal challenges, Anthony Iani worked hard and never gave up. Not only did he earn his bachelor's degree in sociology from MSU, he's the first known athlete with autism to play Division I college basketball. Current sports host Al Martin of WKAR sat down in Studio S recently with Anthony Iani to learn more about his remarkable life.
I mean, it was tough because I mean, there are a lot of different parts of the spectrum for kids with autism. I mean, there's high functioning where, I mean, that's me, where I, to you, I look absolutely normal right now. I'm talking to you, communicating with you. And then there's low functioning where most kids have to be helped out quite a bit. Where growing up, I had a lot of challenges, you know, especially in school. I had a tough time understanding nouns, verbs, idioms, and sarcasm. I still struggle with sarcasm today, but I'm better at it than what I was 10 years ago. So I managed to graduate from Okemos High School in 2007. Played on a couple of great teams. We had the 06 team that was state runner-up, probably played in the greatest Class A state championship game in Michigan high school basketball history. Went to Grand Valley State for 2 years. Proud to say I'm 1-0 against Coach Izzo. We beat him my freshman year. So
that's pretty good, right?
It's not bad. But then we beat Grand Valley State, you know, when I came back, so I'm 1-0 against both schools. So there's an advantage to both that. But, you know, when I came here, it was a bit of a struggle because my first year I was like, okay, so – I had to adapt like to that hardworking mentality that Coach Izzo loves. And luckily, you know, he's watched me play my whole life and he knew how much of a hard worker I was going to be. And so had to work hard, had to earn a lot of respect around here because, you know, the position my dad has, because a lot of people thought I was here because of him, but I wasn't. And I wanted to go out and prove people that I was here for me and nothing else. And I wanted to show people that I was going to get my degree no matter what.
You said, did your parents wait until high school to tell you what the doctors told them when you were 4 years old, and, mm-hmm. and you know, the whole spiel I gave about, you know, they didn't think that you would, you know, amount to where you are right now. Are you glad they waited that long to tell you that, or do you wish they would have told you earlier?
No, I'm glad they did, because I think throughout, like, my early ages of my life, I think they wanted me to live a normal life as much as possible, and then I think they wanted to wait till I was a little more mature so I could understand the situation. I think they thought high school would be the best time to do it, and I think they also forget that, you know, it'll light his fire and then he'll just go beyond places where he never thought he can go. And that's what it did. And so I'm glad they told me just before I turned a freshman in high school. It was like perfect timing.
That was perfect timing. I'm sure you used that as motivation and continue to do so. Now, the issue of bullying when you were growing up, I mean, how did you handle and what sort of things did you go through as a kid growing up and being bullied?
I mean, I was bullied a lot because I was bigger than everybody else. I mean, when I was in sixth grade, I was 6 feet tall and I wore a size 13 shoe.
Wow.
And a lot of kids made fun of me for being bigger than everybody else. But those kids that bullied me had to play me in Little League basketball, and I dropped like 20 points on one of them. And after that, he never said a word to me. But the cool thing was, as I got older, was whenever people were messing with me or disrespecting me, I had my friends who had my back saying, hey, you know, watch him tonight. He's going to go out and prove you wrong in this game. And then I would go out, play hard, do what I can do, and then the next day nobody would say a word. So I had my crew, if you will, to back me up. And that's what's so great about having friends and families, that they can back you up no matter what. But obviously, you know, the other reason why I was bullied is because I have autism. Because when I was in first grade, I did and said things that were, quote-unquote, different than everybody else. And that's why people made fun of me. And, you know, I had one kid who actually tricked me, who I thought he was a fifth grader. I thought he was my boy. I thought he was my guy.
You thought he was your friend.
I thought he was my friend because, mm-hmm. you know, most kids with autism want friends when they grow up. That's what they want. And that's kind of how I felt about this kid. But then one day, him and his buddies pushed my friends away from me at recess, and him and his boys tricked me into putting my tongue on a frozen pole because they knew I would do it.
Oh, no.
But fast forward to 18 years later, I'm walking out of the arena, the Breslin Center, and who's outside waiting for me with a basketball and a Sharpie in both hands, it's that same fifth grader. And I was like, wait, what? Like, what is this guy doing here? And so he asked me, can you sign this ball for me and my little brother? But as I'm signing the ball, I remember one thing. This guy didn't have a brother or sister. So the message I have for kids today are, be careful what you say and do to others, because you never know who that person is going to be in the future.
Life is a funny thing, right?
It really is. It really is.
Again, folks, if you're just now tuning in to WKAR's Current Sports, we're chatting with Anthony Iani, of course, former MSU men's basketball player and national motivational speaker at the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. Now, for you, Ant, you talked about your support system, which really helped you to get through that bullying phase and motivated you throughout life. What made you, coupled with that, of course, you know, being, what made you really a fighter? And why do you think so many kids are bullied, who are bullied growing up, I should say? Why do you think so many kids today just kind of give up on life? Because we see so many times kids who are just, you know, committing suicide due to their stint in school in which kids are bullying them. I mean, what made you a fighter? And why do you think so many kids today give up?
Well, I have Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly, I think, for that, because he gave me my opportunity to start somewhere. And he gave me the opportunity to be a keynote speaker at an autism function in Detroit just before I graduated here in 2012. And that's when I kind of knew I got done. I told my wife, I said, you know what? This is where I belong. I said, I don't know how I'm going to do this, but this is where I belong. And so St. John's Middle School was the first middle school to give me that opportunity. And after that opportunity, I just ran with it. You know, I changed a lot over the years because looking back on how I started out almost 3 years ago, that's like, I go, man, that's how I spoke. Like, you know, that's how I did things. And looking on it now, it's like, okay, it's like watching film and basketball. Okay, I did this well, but I got to go back, add this, do that. And so, but I tell kids, I had a kid ask me up in St. Clair Shores, what motivates me? And this was before my son was born. And I said, you know, it's you guys that motivate me. It's the kids that motivate me, because it's 12,000 kids in a school that motivate me to wake up at 5:30 in the morning, go on the road 5 days at 5 days a week at most, and go and motivate these kids. But now with my son being born, my son Knox motivates me to be the best father I can be and be the best speaker that I can be. Because when my son gets older, I want him to look at what I've did throughout my life and say to his friends, you know, my dad is the most inspirational person that I know. You know, my dad overcame this, overcame that. And so I want my son to use that as motivation too, so he can be great at what he does. But the bullying piece you talk about today is that, you know, I think the reason why kids are bullying others is because of the generation we're in. Because, you know, obviously with you and me growing up, we didn't have Twitter probably until the end of high school. We didn't have Facebook until beginning of high school. And social media has really played a huge part in that, which is, you know, the cyberbullying. And I tell kids everywhere I go that people who cyberbully, Al, those are just gutless cowards. Because they're afraid to walk up to that other person and say what they need to say to them face to face. Because they're scared and they're intimidated by that person.
As Tom Izzo would say, I mean, you know, these are cowards hiding behind a keyboard.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And you wonder why Coach Izzo does not like Twitter.
Right.
And that's why, because of stuff like that. But the other thing people get bullied for, too, is because they're quote-unquote different traits, whether it's their hair color, eye color, skin color, or if they're diagnosed with a learning disability, whether they have autism. Like, people think they could overpower those people and think they're better than that, but they're not. And that's why some kids lose hope. But when I go to schools, my hope and my goal is to try and go out and inspire at least one person, you know, make an impact, leave an impact, even if it is one person. You know, if it's the entire sixth grade class, great, cool. If it's just one person in seventh grade, I'm all right with that. But if it's the entire school, I'm definitely, you know, going to be fine with that. But the one thing I love about my job, Al, is when I get kids walk up to me and share these stories, these personal stories that they don't even share with principals, teachers, or family, and I'm looking at them like, why are you telling me these stories? Like, why aren't you telling somebody else's? But they just open up to me, and I feel like I'm doing something right.
Anthony Iani, former MSU men's basketball player and national motivational speaker. It's been a pleasure, my man.
Thanks, Al. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Yesterday marked the unofficial last day of summer. As we head into fall, farmers' markets will soon be switching out their berries and peaches for apples and pumpkins. Our public poetry announcement this week is an ode to those last sweet peaches of summer. Here is MSU Center for Poetry Director Anita Skeen reading The Exodus of Peaches by Nancy Willard.
The new peach trees are bandaged like the legs of stallions. You can read the bark over the tape's white lip where its russet braille is peeling. The peaches hang in their green cupolas, cheeks stained with twilight, the wind stenciled on velvet livery. What a traffic of coaches without wheels, of bells without tongues! Far off, the barn doors open, close, open, close. An argument, both sides swinging. The blue tractor zippers the field and disappears behind slatted boxes like weathered shingles stained with peach juice. I stood under peaches clumped close as barnacles, loyal as bees, and picked one from the only life it knew.
That was The Exodus of Peaches by poet Nancy Willard, read by director of the MSU Center for Poetry, Anita Skeen. Our public poetry announcements are produced in partnership with the MSU Center for Poetry. And that's our show for today. Glad you could join us. Tomorrow on Current State, some area residents are saying the Lansing City market is underperforming. Are they right? And how exactly do you draw more people to the marketplace near Lansing's riverfront? We'll learn more from Lansing City Market's new manager, Audrey Tipper, along with Scott Keith of LEPFA, which oversees the market. Plus, you don't have to wait for Halloween to be scared out of your wits. Camp Hatchet is described as a once-in-a-lifetime haunted camping experience. Current State Scott Pohl talks with Jennifer Butinsky about this uniquely terrifying event. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Thanks also to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Katie Cook, and to Drew Hill for engineering. Don't forget, we're a podcast as well as a radio program and a website. Just subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, connect with us on social media at KAR Current State on Twitter and on Facebook. Current State from WKAR. Don't forget, pop-up stories tomorrow evening, 5:30 to 7 at the Allen Neighborhood Center in Lansing. If you have a story to tell about being hungry and fed, or you just like to listen to the others, please join us 5:30 till 7 tomorrow evening at the Allen Neighborhood Center in Lansing. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.